Vibes Are Bad, that one's won it. It's good though.
Fifth alarm. Working structure fire. 7741 Liberty Road Drive.
It's 9 a.m. on May 18th, 2024. Residents of Charlotte, North Carolina wake up to the smell and sight of black smoke billowing up into the sky. The source: a massive seven-story apartment complex, home to 239 luxury units, or at least what should have been luxury units. At the time, the structure was still under construction, meaning that thankfully no residents were living there. But this in and of itself presented two major problems. The first was that, in its current state, the top five floors were primarily just the bones of the structure, made almost entirely of wooden insulation, making the building as a whole extremely flammable. Meaning that, although the fire had started out relatively small, it was quickly going to consume the entire complex if it wasn't put out quickly. Which brings us to the second and even more glaring problem. The building was actively under construction when the fire started, and that morning, 17 construction workers had clocked in, all of whom were now in grave danger. And by the time the firefighters arrived on the scene, the situation was already dire. And so firefighters rushed in, finding a large group of the employees and leading them out to safety. Though when they made it outside, they made the horrifying realization that they had only found 15 of them. Somewhere within that labyrinth of burning wooden walls, two men were left behind, trapped and calling out to anyone who might hear them. And these pleas weren't just being made to those on the scene, as in the following minutes, one of the trapped men, 30-year-old Demonte Sherrill, would take out his phone, open up Facebook, and go live, revealing the horrifying reality that both he and his friend had found themselves in.
Somebody say hell, we're at South Park.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of the internet, and we thought you might want to come along.
You gotta do it now. Now or never.
Yo, what the fuck?
If you own a computer, here's how to get the most out of it. Watch this.
Yo. I'm at South Park right now. At work. And the building on fire. And I can't get out.
The stream showed Demonte Sherrill and his friend Ruben Holmes somewhere deep within the prospective apartment complex. And though the fire hadn't yet reached them, the smoke certainly had, blanketing them in a thick, impenetrable fog, not only making breathing extremely difficult, but also making it nearly impossible for rescuers to see them.
It's getting harder and harder for them to see us. We're going to have to stand out here and see. The building on fire, I'm trapped inside, me and my man.
This was likely one of the reasons why Demonte chose to start this livestream, hopeful that it could show rescuers exactly where they were. But based on the footage, their positioning was far from ideal. They were on the second highest floor, floor 6, which had only one access point, a single stairway that was on the complete opposite side of the building. And based on their testimony in the footage, something had clearly blocked their path to that one remaining exit, meaning that the only other way out would be to jump. Though at 6 stories in the air, and falling into what would likely be the heart of the fire, this would have meant certain death. There was quite literally nowhere for them to go. Rescue was their only hope.
Chat, I once saw a video, maybe you guys have seen it before. Some guy, chat, go on a part like this and swing down onto that over and over again. You guys seen it before? Not a movie. It's a real fire.
Yo, this building is on fire. I'm at work. Somebody say hell, we're at South Park.
Seemingly realizing this, Demonte began to grow more desperate, yelling out into the void of smoke, while Ruben can be seen in the background waving his phone flashlight, with both men doing anything they could to help rescuers find them. Before... the stream abruptly ends. Rescuers were aware of the unfolding situation on the sixth story. They first tried to reach the men by using a massive crane with a basket attached, which can actually be seen in Demonte's livestream. Though in it, you can see that it's also facing the complete wrong direction, as the smoke was just that impenetrable. However, at one point, it's believed that the crane operator did actually see these men, but the blaze was just too extreme, leading to the operator himself having to be rescued. This left only one real option for saving DeMonte and Ruben. They were going to have to go in after them. And so they climbed that stairway up to floor 6 and started their trek to the opposite end of the structure. Though before they could even make it halfway, the rescuers were relegated to a slow crawl as the inferno around them raged more and more intensely and the smoke grew thicker and thicker. Though that's when they began to hear screaming. Somewhere, lost in that maze, Ruben and DeMonte were yelling as loud as they could for help. This sound was a sign that they were getting close. Though just then, rescuers would be met with another sound.
All companies working 7741 Liberty Road Drive, evacuate structure per command. All companies working 7741 Liberty Road Drive, evacuate structure.
Command all companies, this will be defensive at this time.
We'll be ready for this side to collapse. Everybody get out of the collapse zone.
Confirming you are coming out, but you're not out of the building.
Thank you, we are on our way out.
With the order being made for all of them to evacuate, as by this point, the structure was engulfed in flames, and a collapse was imminent. The firefighters tried to call out to the two in one last attempt to guide them towards rescue, but they never came. In fact, at that point, the structure fell eerily silent. They would leave that structure and minutes later, the fire consumed the entire building, with the temperature inside reaching 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Before...
It collapsed.
So what about a helicopter with just a long rope?
And inside, DeMonte and Ruben would become the sole fatalities of this catastrophe.
Yo, I'm at South Park right now. At work, in a building on fire. And I can't get out. It's getting harder and harder for them to see it.
Knowing how the story ends would make this live stream difficult for anyone to watch, but what I find most upsetting about it is that the majority of those who initially watched this were his own friends and family that followed him on Facebook, with these viewers including his own mother. And a lot of them probably had no idea he even worked this job, as he had just been hired that week. His brother had also caught the stream as it was happening and actually rushed over to the scene where he pleaded with the firefighters to watch the footage. But despite doing the best they could, there was just too much working against them to save DeMonte and Ruben. Following an investigation into the fire, it was discovered that the crew was using an organic foam insulation, which was known to be extremely flammable and produce thick black smoke. And this became deadly when the machine used to spray that insulation...
I feel like sometimes... Listen, this comes from a dumbass bystander like me, okay? There are things that are kind of creative that people don't think about, and they could have done something for sure. There's no shot in an open side building like that. There's nothing anybody can do. There's definitely some shit that they could have come up with that actually just works. Come on, bro. Come on, bro.
Hot fire, sending the whole building up in flames, where they had yet to install any sort of smoke detector or alarm system to alert the crew of a fire. Making matters worse, there had been a temporary set of stairs made right where the two men had been trapped.
A relay of hook and ladders or some shit with a rope attached to the top and then they go down. Dude, it doesn't have to be perfect. You guys always think it has to be perfect. It has to be sound. It has to be engineered properly. It has a nice elevator. No, bro. It could be as dumb as like some piece of thing that you attach and it could go down the floor and then go down the floor. It could be literally anything.
But that stairwell had just been removed in order to make way for the permanent set of stairs. Because of this and a myriad of other issues, the companies involved with this construction were forced to pay a fine of $50,000 and are currently being sued by the families of both victims. But regardless of the outcome, nothing will ever make up for the loss of DeMonte Sherrill and Ruben Holmes.
50,000?
Things were getting concerning. Johnny Cashman spoke to his family nearly every single day, but now, on the sixth day without receiving any communication from him, they knew that something was wrong. Johnny lived in Lynchburg, Virginia, hundreds of miles away from his home in Maine, and so, being unable to check on him themselves, they called police in the area and requested a welfare check. Police entered Johnny's apartment on the 19th of April, 2022, and hours later, they would call his parents.
Last pause. This is, oh dude, do you genuinely believe that ideas you came up with on the spot would be better ideas than maybe a professional 10,000 experience? Brother, how many videos have we seen that where there's an actual possible solution. And it, dude, it's just because they're liable. It's because people are liable. It's like if they try something and it fails, they're liable for whatever happened. So a lot of times they just do fucking nothing. But it actually so happens that a lot of times there's something that could have been done. 100%. Just like a TEPCO and the nuclear reactor, right? Like, it's not because the professionals are saying something that it's the best outcome.
It's the news that they had found their son dead on the floor. According to the officers, Johnny had experienced some sort of medical event that led to GI bleeding that ultimately claimed his life. But this made no sense to Johnny's family. He was only 38 years old and had just been given a clean bill of health after a full medical exam only 4 months prior. It was so out of the blue, in fact, that they even asked if there were any signs of a struggle or if there was any evidence that he may have taken his own life. But they were assured that there was no trauma, no drugs, and nothing suspicious found on the scene. And that, as shocking as it was, his cause of death was entirely natural and had likely just been spurred on by drinking and tobacco use, with the only solace being that Johnny didn't suffer, as they stated that he had died instantly. Because of this, no autopsy was performed, as the case seemed as straightforward as it gets. And despite his family questioning if they should get their own autopsy, they were told by officers that it wouldn't be necessary. And so, Johnny's body was cremated and sent back to Maine, in what seemed to be the end of Johnny Cashman's story. Huh? Ten days after Johnny's body was discovered, his ex-girlfriend and her mother made their way back to his apartment in order to retrieve some of her belongings. She knew that re-entering the space was going to be difficult, but ultimately, there was no way she could have prepared for what was waiting for her inside. There was blood everywhere. It was pooled in the bathrooms, wiped on doors, spread all over the living space, and was even found on a chair and a banister. But the most horrifying part of it all was the walls. They were covered in splattered blood, which revealed long, streaking handprints. It was something straight out of a horror movie, and although Johnny's cause of death was deemed natural, what they found in that apartment seemed anything but. Traumatized by what they were witnessing, the pair snapped multiple photos of the bloodshed and ran out of the unit, directly into Johnny's neighbor. This neighbor revealed that they believed something far worse than a medical emergency had happened to Johnny, as they had a security camera mounted to their door which faced Johnny's unit, and on the day of his passing, it captured something incredibly disturbing. The footage shows Johnny making his way up the flight of stairs leading to his apartment at around 3:03 p.m. Nothing seems out of the ordinary at all, though it is noteworthy that he was holding an empty glass, perhaps insinuating that he had been drinking. But this doesn't seem to impair his movements much at all, as he punches...
Much at all.
Nothing seems out of the ordinary at all. Though it is noteworthy that he was holding an empty glass, perhaps insinuating that he had been drinking. But this doesn't seem to impair his movements much at all, as he punches in the code and enters his home, just as he did every other day. But moments later, something happens inside that unit, and while it goes unseen, it doesn't go unheard.
Oh, but how does this guy get in then? What, is it a dog?
The audio seems to depict a man yelling, asking repeatedly, "What are you doing?" and begging for something to stop. On top of this, you can also hear loud thuds and banging. Almost as if things were falling over inside, or there was some sort of physical altercation, before the unit then goes quiet just a few seconds later. It was unclear if this voice was Johnny's, or perhaps someone else who had been inside the unit. But regardless, one thing was apparent from this audio. There was someone else in that apartment, despite the fact that Johnny lived alone. And just 7 minutes later, this unseen person would emerge. This clearly wasn't Johnny, and after leaving the unit, the anonymous man nearly makes it out of the building before he seems to change his mind.
Why the doorknob?
Turning around and walking back up the stairs before fiddling with the door handle, touching it only with his sleeve, like he was wiping off his fingerprints.
Can the guy didn't see the camera?
He then walks down the stairs and stops once again, where he seems to be in a state of shock over whatever had just transpired, before he composes himself and walks out of the building. But the footage wasn't quite finished yet.
What motives, though?
Help! Help! Help!
Just 1 minute later, you can hear Johnny shouting for help from inside the apartment, to which moments after, he stops, and no further sound or activity would come from Johnny's unit until police arrived 5 days later. The footage and the scene at the apartment seemed to contradict what Johnny's family had been told about his death. The blood all over made it obvious that Johnny's death had not happened in an instant, and this, coupled by the presence of this unknown man who is clearly distraught and wiping off his fingerprints, as well as the sound of the apparent struggle inside, seemed to point towards something much more sinister than what was initially conveyed to the family. But even with this footage, police still believed that Johnny's death was due to a medical emergency, as they quickly changed their initial story, saying that the blood spread was due to uncontrollable vomiting, and that Johnny had in fact likely suffered, at least for a short while. But this medical emergency wasn't elaborated on, as they didn't truly know what caused it, as no autopsy was ever performed, nor could one ever be performed, as by this point, Johnny was already cremated, and cremated because of the officer's initial statements. So if Johnny had actually been murdered, which the footage does seem to suggest,
Chat,
there was now virtual...
I have a question, Chat. Chat, what if a department or whatever, a police or whatever, you know, they kind of just sweep it under the rug or whatever. Does it escalate further if from just like, let's say a civilian request or whatever? If civilians go like, yo, dude, this is like cook. And then the department goes like, you know what? Shit just kind of happened. Is what it is. See ya or whatever. Does it not go further up the chain?
Actually, no way to prove it. And what makes this even more frustrating is that law enforcement already had this footage. It was collected that very day, and they either didn't fully look through it or didn't think that this was overly suspicious. But everyone else surely did. And soon, this video began making the rounds online, leading to one glaring question being asked. Who is this man? As no one in Johnny's life recognized him. Well, it wouldn't be until May 11th that investigators would finally ID him as Stephen Church, and upon being questioned, he revealed that he had moved to Lynchburg for work, but the opportunity he had lined up fell through shortly after he arrived, leaving him with no money and without a place to stay, which is when he met Johnny, who offered to let him crash on his couch. He supposedly stayed with Johnny for 3 days, and described Johnny as an alcoholic who drank constantly, including on that fateful day. When Johnny arrived home, Stephen claims that he started drunkenly yelling at him about paying rent, which led to the two getting into a verbal altercation. But he insisted that this altercation never turned physical, and that he left immediately after, to which he quickly went back to clean his prints because he was afraid that Johnny would try and have him arrested for squatting. And having already racked up 2 felonies in his life, Stephen was paranoid about going back to jail.
Sure.
But when Stephen was leaving, he did mention seeing Johnny hunched over the toilet as if he were going to vomit, but he claims to have left before this so-called medical emergency started. This is the gist of Stephen's account from that day. But the problem is, it doesn't really match up with what we're hearing in the video.
Yo, what the fuck? Yo, what are you doing? Yo, what the fuck, dude?
From the footage, we can hear everything going on in that unit, but at no point do we hear any sort of an argument, nor do we hear anything about rent, with the phrases lending themselves more to a physical struggle rather than a verbal one. In fact, the whole time, it appears that we're only hearing one voice. But there is an exception. To my knowledge, it's never been conclusively determined whose voice is who in the recording, and either scenario paints a far different picture of what may have happened inside that room. But regardless, this audio makes it clear that Steven's story was fabricated at least to some degree, as he also fails to account for the loud banging in the background. And because of this, his version of events is generally rejected, with most people seeming to believe one of two main theories.
Most people?
The first is that, upon arriving home, Johnny and Steven had gotten into a physical altercation, resulting in Johnny taking some sort of blow to his abdomen, which in turn triggered or exacerbated this medical emergency. GI bleeds are horrific, and can certainly cause the level of bleeding that was found in the apartment. And perhaps seeing all the blood coming from Johnny, Steven started yelling at him, before deciding to run off, fearing that he would be charged for murder. This would explain Steven's demeanor and actions after leaving the apartment, and why he may have fabricated his story,
as
he knew or knows that he was directly responsible for Johnny's death. And this blow to the abdomen could have easily been missed by investigators, as the injuries would have been primarily internal. The second theory is that upon arriving home, Johnny naturally experienced a medical emergency leading to this catastrophic GI bleed. Upon seeing this and perhaps being in a state of shock, Steven yelled at him, demanding to know what was happening and telling him to stop, as perhaps he was moving around the apartment and tracking blood everywhere, which would explain the other voice saying, "I can't stop." I could see how this experience would make no sense to Steven, and perhaps just having no idea what was happening, he left and tried to make it look like he was never there, as he was afraid of being blamed for whatever was happening to Johnny, and so he essentially left Johnny there to die, whether knowingly or unknowingly. What bothers me about this theory is why 911 was never called, not only by Steven, but by Johnny too, as his phone was found in the unit with blood on it, implying that he had it in his hand at some point, though it's possible that the massive blood loss just made him too disoriented. Both of these theories seem believable, or at least more so than the explanation that Steven had given. However, in October of 2022, Johnny's case would officially be closed for good, with Steven being cleared of any wrongdoing, as Johnny's death was labeled the same way that it always has been, a medical emergency that couldn't be further elaborated on, with the most relevant evidence being that Steven's shoe prints were not found in the blood, but Johnny's were, implying that he had not been part of the struggle. But in my mind, this can be explained by both theories mentioned previously. Though regardless, without the possibility of an autopsy, this is likely where this case ends for good.
Yeah, but he says stop. So stop what? And also, he didn't ask for like help until later.
With this disturbing footage,
but
I can't help but think that there's more to the story.
How is this guy not somewhat liable though?
Than we may ever know. It was around 7:30 a.m. on a warm July morning back in 2019. 17-year-old Bethany Martin and a 16-year-old friend decide to walk to a gas station near their home in San Antonio, Texas. And as the two of them made their way down the road, their path brought them parallel to a drainage ditch, which was often filled with various trash and other discarded material. But on this day, something far more interesting caught their eye. It looked like a man crouching down and leaned up against one of the concrete walls. But the closer they got, the more they realized how unusual his posture was. He looked completely unnatural, and he wasn't moving. And by the time they came face to face with him, the reality of the situation would hit them. They had just found a dead body. This discovery was enough to traumatize anyone, especially two teenagers, and upon calling the police and being sent on their way, Bethany and her friend would make the long walk back home contemplating what to do next, before they eventually landed on the idea of sharing their experience with the world. And so, as soon as they got in the door, they began to set up lights and their camera in order to film a TikTok. The clip showed the two sitting on a couch appearing to be in a state of shock, with the words, "Us remembering we found a dead body this morning," plastered on the screen, offering no other context aside from the description, which simply read, "I wish we were kidding. All respect to the family."
Respect what?
Some offered sympathy for the girls, while others viewed their post as insensitive and exploitative. But others weren't even convinced it was real, partially due to this glaring lack of context. But any doubt of this post's legitimacy would be quickly thwarted by a discovery made not even one full day later,
but did they not call the police,
as it was
though?
Revealed that this recording hadn't actually been the only video that these two girls had made on that fateful day. On their walk to the gas station, the girls had stumbled across the body of 25-year-old Marcus Adams, with the young man having seemingly perished earlier that morning, with it being apparent that he had taken his own life. But upon finding Marcus, the girls weren't actually overwhelmed with sadness or even shock, as instead, their focus immediately went to something far different, as something on the man's body had caught their attention. His necklace. The girls really liked it. In fact, the unnamed 16-year-old had said that it matched her fashion perfectly.
What?
And so, before police arrived, the two would once again pull out their phone and start recording, showing Bethany approaching the body with her intention being to grab his necklace. Which she eventually does, removing the medallion and giving it to her friend, before tossing the chain into the grass nearby, leading to the girls running away from the scene. The 16-year-old would then post that video onto her Snapchat story, for all of her close friends to see.
And they don't call the police, though?
I can't show the footage for obvious reasons, but it's truly awful. And just based on the audio alone, you can tell that they're very obviously having fun doing this.
You gotta do it now. Now or never. Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. Oh my god, oh my god.
Yo.
There's something so uniquely disturbing about it. It's clear that upon finding the body, there was no real emotional impact on them, at least none that outweighed their desire to steal from it. And as if stealing from this man who had just taken his own life, and posting it for all their friends to see as if it were a joke, wasn't horrible enough, they then immediately posted this other video to TikTok in an attempt to garner sympathy. It's truly awful, and made even more appalling by reports that claim that the 16-year-old had actually worn this medallion in the TikTok video and in others made following its posting. And unfortunately, their actions had even more upsetting consequences, as the footage from their Snapchat story was quickly downloaded by someone they knew and posted onto an app called Nextdoor, with the footage being totally uncensored. And it was on this app where it's claimed that many of Marcus Adams' own family members would see the footage, many of whom weren't even aware that he was deceased. Just one day after posting this TikTok, both girls were questioned by the police after the incident and the footage was reported to them, and as a result, Bethany would be charged with theft of a human corpse, but would ultimately avoid any serious jail time.
Wait, really?
Meanwhile, the 16-year-old's name and charges were never publicly released, but we do know that the medallion was returned to the family.
Chat, isn't failing to report a fucking dead body also bad? I'm confused. Isn't that another charge? I'm confused.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, Bethany would later come back to her TikTok page shortly after her arrest and share her side of the story, where she gave a less than half-hearted apology while also claiming to be the victim, saying that her friend had pressured her to steal from Marcus as well as pressured her into making that TikTok in the first place because she thought it would be a hit. Though obviously this didn't go over well.
Oh, that's awful.
On December 20th, 1984, 12-year-old Janelle Matthews disappeared from her home in Greeley, Colorado, in the evening hours. Earlier that day, she had sung at a Christmas concert with her school's choir, which her parents were unable to attend, as her mother was out of town and her father had gone to her sister's basketball game nearby, leading to Janelle catching a ride home with a friend, being dropped off at her house sometime around 8:15, where she excitedly spoke to her father on the phone, letting him know that she had arrived home safe and sound. Approximately 1 hour later, her father, Jim Matthews, pulled into the driveway to find the garage door wide open, and the house completely empty. Janelle was gone, leaving behind her winter coat and even her shoes, despite it being a frigid, snowy night. And it was within that snow that was quickly piling up that lie one of the only real clues left behind at the scene. Footprints, leading directly to one of the home's windows, insinuating that someone had been watching Janelle.
12-year-old Janelle Matthews disappeared from her Greeley home 1 month ago today. It's believed she's the victim of a kidnapping. She has not been seen or heard from since December 20th.
Her disappearance became a big news story almost immediately, with the whole community and really the whole country becoming invested in the fate of this girl, thanks in large part to her being one of the very first milk carton kids, meaning that her face and information about her disappearance was shown on countless milk cartons all across the country to get the word out. And as a result, this case became huge in the mainstream media, as even politicians began to make note of Janelle's story, with then-President Ronald Reagan mentioning the girl in one of his speeches.
I learned about Jonelle Matthews of Greeley, Colorado, 5 days before Christmas. Jonelle disappeared from her home.
Though even with this publicity, this didn't necessarily guarantee results. And soon, months would turn to years, and eventually to decades. And all the while, Jonelle's whereabouts remained a complete mystery. Eventually, the rise of the internet would start to play a key role in this case, where even in the late 2010s, over 3 decades after she had vanished, her case was still being shared and still being discussed, just as it had been 3 decades prior.
Oh yeah, the huge AI to see how it would
for politicians, even as recently as 2019. When a man running for governor of Idaho mentioned her disappearance in a Facebook post, 35 full years later. Regardless of Jonelle's whereabouts, her case was still very much alive, as the world, and especially Jonelle's parents, were haunted by the question, what happened to Jonelle Matthews? But sure enough, in late 2019, they would finally get their answer.
Bones found in Weld County earlier this week appeared to bring an end to a 3-decade-long search for a missing 12-year-old girl. The Greeley Tribune is reporting they are those of Jonelle Matthews.
On Tuesday, July 23rd, 2019, at roughly 4:50 p.m., a crew had been digging in an isolated field in Weld County, Colorado, in order to install a new pipeline, when they would uncover the decayed remains of a little girl. It was Jonelle, still wearing those clothes that she had worn to her recital, meaning she had likely died the very day she disappeared, having been killed by a single gunshot wound to the head. Jonelle Matthews had been murdered in cold blood, and almost immediately upon finding her body, the police would also zero in on their suspect. The man's name was Stephen Pankey, and at the time of Jonelle's disappearance, he had been living in the same general area in Colorado. But by 2019, Stephen had long since fled the area, as after the crime, he would eventually pack up seemingly out of the blue and move to Idaho, where when Jonelle's body was discovered, he just so happened to be running for governor.
Bro. What the fuck?
Was Stephen Pankey her body, the police would also zero in on their suspect. The man's name was Stephen Pankey, and at the time, he moved to be running for governor.
I thought I misheard, but...
And during his campaign, Pankey had put out a bizarre Facebook post about Jonelle, calling for the Colorado DA to oversee a fresh investigation, as he stated that the local police had wrongly been focused on the theory that Jonelle's disappearance was a child abduction and murder, which was quite convenient, as just a few months after posting this, he would be arrested for the abduction and murder of Jonelle Matthews. Police believe that Jonelle had first caught Stephen's eye when he was working as a janitor at the church she attended, with this leading to him stalking her and eventually abducting her on that fateful night, where he threw Jonelle in his car and ultimately ended her life, for no reason other than his sick satisfaction. He then proceeded to bury her in a field 20 miles away, in a spot that he was certain no one would ever find her. Now, the evidence supporting this is mainly circumstantial, but it is incredibly concerning. Just one day after Jonelle's abduction, Pankey decided to take his wife to California in order to celebrate the holidays with his parents, with this trip being completely unplanned, as his wife was only told of it literally the day of. And making things stranger, when they returned home, Stephen's car conveniently caught fire and was burned to a crisp, to which he offered no explanation for. But in response, he would take the car to a local scrapyard where it would be even further destroyed, taking any potential evidence along with it. But while this is all strange enough, police say that the main indicator that Stephen was their man was his clear obsession with Jonelle's case. Shortly after the slaying, Stephen began listening and watching any news reports he could on Jonelle's case, while also having his wife read every single article about the missing girl out loud, to which he would often have her repeat them over and over again. But his obsession didn't stop there, as he would then start frequently calling the police, wanting to talk to them about the case, even going as far as to give them potential leads, as he claimed to be fearful that he was going to be blamed for the crime, despite having seemingly never even met her. And it was during some of these many unusual phone calls that he was said to have given details on her disappearance that were never actually made public. His obsession was entirely uncanny, bringing up her disappearance at random even decades later, with his Facebook post being a perfect example. And as it turns out, one of Stephen's most incriminating statements came as a result of something he mentioned in that infamous message.
Self-report, Andy.
In it, Stephen says that his son Carl had been murdered in 2008, which is in fact true, as the murder was actually fully solved, with it being confirmed that Stephen had nothing to do with it. But when he was mourning the loss of Carl, something unusual happened. His now ex-wife recalled that following Carl's death, Pinky never once cried until the day before his memorial service, where she watched him from a distance walk up to their son's urn and begin to sob, eventually blurting out, "I hope God didn't allow this to happen because of Janelle Matthews." Despite maintaining his innocence to this day, Pinky was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 2040, his conviction coming 12,634 days after Janelle Matthews' disappearance, with Pinky's cryptic Facebook post serving as a dark relic of his twisted obsession that would eventually expose him as Janelle.
So how did they get him then? Is it just all the circumstantial shit is like overwhelming and it's just gonna like de facto win? I don't know how that works.
Janelle's killer.
Maybe.
I want to give a massive shout out to my buddy, Ryan, aka Nexpo. A lot of you already know this, but Ryan is...
Well, I don't know how that works, because I know things can be circumstantial, but what if there's like fucking 20 things that are all circumstantial by themselves, but they all are also could be linked to thing, and does that not like make it win? Interesting. I enjoyed that.